Good morning. I'm Doug Rademacher, and this is the Fisher Body Historical team, and we are in the conference room of the 602 Union Hall. Today is November 15th. It's approximately 9:30 a.m. We are here to interview Mark Gross. Mark, would you please say your name, spell it for the record, last name?
Mark Gross, M-A-R-K-G-R-O-C-E.
And your address?
522 West Frederick, Lansing, Michigan.
Excellent. And you have a nickname. Could you share what that is?
My nickname is Blue.
Okay. Blue, would you share with me, what is your marital status?
I'm single.
And do you have any children?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Okay. And can you share your education level?
I went to high school at Charlotte, went 12 grades, and then I did 2 years of LCC welding and a few computer courses on how-to and all that, but other than that, that's about it.
So, and do you have any military service?
No, I do not.
Okay, at this time I'm going to go around the room and introduce all the people that are here in the room today.
Marilyn Coulter.
Linda Johnson.
Doreen Howard.
John Fedor.
Cheryl McQuaid.
Mike Fleming.
I'd like to start today, Mark, with your hire-in date. Could you share your first day, your seniority, and a little bit about that?
Well, I hired in September of 76, just a few months after high school. And my first day, they came in for what they called an interview. I wasn't really expecting them to hire me on the spot or anything. But they brought us in, and they the first thing they did was send us right down to medical. And didn't even talk to us or anything. And then they brought us back, and they put us in the employment office, and we got to sit around for 10 or 15 minutes while other bosses came in and selected people from the group. And I got selected by Bill Bosworth Sr. for the trim department. So that was pretty cool.
Was there a point where you stood in line to get an application? Can you share that?
No, my dad brought one home.
Oh.
He used to work here as well. He was part of the industrial truck repair group. And so he brought an application home, and I filled it out, and he sent it back. So, and that's how I got the application itself.
And did they call you at home, or did you receive a letter?
I received a kind of a 5x7 postcard informing me of the interview.
Excellent. Do you remember which department you hired into?
It was the trim department. They put in the interiors. First job I got was bolting down seat belts. That was a hard job. We worked for 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. After the first few days, my hands swelled up so bad that I couldn't hardly use them for anything else. But that only lasted a couple of weeks until they got used to the holding the guns and stuff. So it was pretty cool.
So, Mark, you said your father worked here. Would you share with us about the feeling of coming in? You said you didn't realize they were going to hire you immediately, but did you have an impression of what factory life was going to be like, the workplace, or was it new to you, and can you share that experience?
It was really new to me. I hadn't pictured work in a shop to be more like a machine shop or like it was at school and stuff like that, but this was a lot more intense. They built more cars, and they built more things, and so it was a lot of repetitive work. I wasn't ready for it even as a kid, so it was cool.
I'd like to know, when you hired in, what was your plan? Did you have something that you decided you were going to do, or were you going to use your employment here as a stepping stone?
No, I was 18 years old. And I needed a job. And when I came to work here, I had no thoughts of the future or anything like that. I just came to work. It worked out to be a really good place to work, and so I stayed. However, my education has been for industrial arts. We had machine shop in school, and we had wood shop in school, and we've had you know, welding classes and stuff, because that was my original intent, was to be a welder. That's what I trained for when I was in high school and thereafter. But I had no vision of the future.
Since you did envision yourself as a welder, there was welding available in the plant. Did you ever get that opportunity?
Yes, I welded doors in the body shop for a while.
So from your original job where you said it was very difficult, the seatbelt bolt, let's start there. Would you share that first day and the supervisor that selected you, how did you guys hit it off? What was that like?
Well, Bill Bosworth Sr. was an experienced foreman and knew a lot about people and a lot of the area. And he brought me and three other guys up to the 3X area, where at the time they were running two lines side by side. And that was a big area, a big building. And we found his desk, and it was in the middle of just confusion and everywhere, as far as I could tell. And I put my lunch down, and he showed us our jobs. He introduced me to a girl called Annie. And she was putting in the rear seatbelt bolts. And she taught me to do that, and we did that half of the day or so. And then we went to lunch. Everybody split. And I walked around that place for 20 minutes trying to find my lunch. I finally found it. Had about, just enough time to eat it and get back to my position before the lunchtime got over. But it was quite a hectic day.
You said 3X. What is 3X?
3X is the large trim building. It's a part of the whole Fisher Body plant. It's just one particular building part of it, that's all.
Okay. Now, you said this job was difficult and you met Annie. Now, what was your thought when you were given a job and to be trained by a woman? Do you have any thought about that? Did that give you...
No, she was a lot better at it than I was and knew how to hit that hole and get them seatbelts in there real darn quick. It took me forever. Every time she'd give me the gun, I'd be down the line so far she'd have to work for 5 minutes to get me back up again. I thought I'd never get it.
So you gained the respect for... It didn't matter.
Oh, she let... At the end of the day, she walked out of there just as quick as everybody and everything, and I'm like dragging my butt trying to find a door. I mean, I was in bad shape for that.
Did you see your father that night?
No. He was on the day shift. I got hired onto the second shift, so I was pretty much on my own. However, he did come and see me the next week, you know, and that was nice to... He stopped by the job. I didn't have time to talk, but he stopped by the job and watched me work for a while and seen what job I had and told me it was a good job, and he was glad to see me, and then he left, so...
Well, good. So, how long did you stay in the trim department, and then you said you got to go to welding. Was this... Can you give the time frame?
Oh, that was years later. I didn't actually go to the welding right away. When I originally hired in there, I worked in the trim area for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. I went from being the seatbelt bolt operator to being a utility person in the area so I could learn all the jobs and have a little variety of something to do for our area. There were 30 people in our area, probably 15 operations. And so I got to go and be the utility person for almost a year. And then I went to we had a pickup guy at the end of the area who repaired everything. And I got that job, and I was that for 6 months or so, and then Artie Brown found me and decided he liked the way I worked and could repair stuff. And so I went to the end-of-line repair. I was repairing the back glass moldings and the seat cushions and things like that that came through that weren't quite right. And I worked there for a year, year and a half, and then they put me offline for the next 4 years, offline repair. It was a horseshoe at the very end where the more difficult repair jobs were done, and we changed glass on the cars, we'd fix the vinyl tops, we'd fix the wiring if it wasn't correct. If things were wrong, things got damaged, they brought them to us and we repaired them. And I spent my time there for 4 years or so until they cut out or reduced the repair group. Okay? At that time, I got put back into the line group operations. And I went into the intermittent relief job again, where I was repairing on the line, like a pickup person. And then after that, I decided, well, I didn't really, you know, I was getting too old to be working on the line like that, so I put in for material. And at the time, they were expanding the material department, and so I was hired into the material, and we went through 2 weeks of training or something like that, where they would let us drive part-time, learn to stack baskets. They would identify various docks, train loading areas, and places, stock areas, so we'd know what we were doing. So we were trained for 2 weeks before they brought us out on the floor. And at that time, I got they sent me to the body shop, and we laid down side frames, which was all the parts for one half of the car. And it was built on a kind of a flat thing. But anyway, I'd bring parts in and put them so the guys could use them to build these parts. That was part of the material group. There were some big baskets out there. These things were 10, 12 feet wide by 15, 20 feet long. And these were huge baskets, and we had to get them in there pretty quick and stuff. So that was real interesting. And I worked out there for a year until one of the layoffs, when they reorganized the material department, and I requested to go to the trim department because I had worked in trim previously. And so I got sent into the trim department, and they sent me to Dock 15 as utility. Dock 15 was the major influx of material for Trip Fisher Body in the plant. There was 12, 15 guys out there all the time working to deliver stock. And I got put into a team of three, and we unloaded two different bays. And we'd unload stock from the trucks and deliver them to the storage areas and bring back empties and reload the trucks. And it was kind of an interesting place to work. There was a lot going on.
Linda Johnson.
How many trucks did they unload a day or for a shift?
For Dock 15?
Just for Dock 15.
Between 36 and 42, generally speaking. I did not know this at the time, but as time went by, I became more involved with dock operations and have learned quite a bit since then. But at the time, there was quite a few trucks that came in per shift. So we were moving. As individuals, we would move one truck every hour and a half, 2 hours. And you times that by 15 people or so, and that works out to quite a workload. Mm-hmm. So,
Mark, I want to take you back. You did say that you had trained in welding back in high school, and you said you got an opportunity to do that in the body shop. I don't remember you sharing that yet. Could you talk about getting that chance and what it was like compared to what you learned in school?
Well, when I got out of school originally, I worked for a little company called Service Fab, and they made things like the racks that the carpets go on and stuff like that. And at the time, I was a welder there, okay? One thing I did learn at the time was that welding is a very dirty job, dirty and smelly job. And so working in the trim department was better. However, at one point, we had a layoff or a cutback, and I was reduced out of material along with half of the other group. And so at the time, I was sent to the body shop to take over operations for somebody there, and I got sent to the door area. And so I got the job of welding online, as far as welding the interiors of the doors and stuff like that, a little MIG welder, and we'd, you know, do the spots on the where the headers came together and stuff like that for the door frames. And that wasn't nearly as much fun as being out in the trim area as a truck driver. So when the opportunity came and they rehired more people, I transferred back out to material. I did weld there for a while, but it's not anything like welding in a shop, a fabrication shop, production welding is one piece after another. It's not real welding. It's part A to part B 7,000 times a day. Okay, so it's not like welding. Okay, it's not like where you take a trailer frame or something like that, have to bevel the edges and get it cleaned out, you know, and then do your tack welds and then do your fill welds and then do your finish welds. You know, it's not like that at all. So it was different.
Marilyn Coulter.
Mark, what was the difference between working in the trim shop and working in the body shop, just as far as production was?
The goals were the same. It was a bit noisier and harder to communicate with people down in the body shop. And there was certain things like coveralls and gloves that you had to do every day that you didn't have to do in the trim department. And so overall, it wasn't nearly as pleasant, because you're always in a hurry getting things done and you never had time to do anything. Even your jobs were set up where you had to do these and then move to the next machine and do these and then move to the next machine and do these. And you didn't really have time in between to stop and talk with the people and say, hey, how you doing? You know, because you had to be like within a foot or two of somebody to hear them. You know what I'm saying? So it made communication difficult in the body shop.
Mike Fleming.
So you talked about earlier when you were on 21 that, and you were in three-man teams. Okay. And can you tell us how those three-man teams and that type of material coming in then changed when we went to just-in-time and the different changes on the dot?
To start with, it was dock 15, because it was building 15, the main dock. And there's the trim stuff, not the body shop stuff, coming in. When we were doing the three-man teams, we would have two bays per team, and we'd be unloading one truck at a time and reloading the other truck back at the time, so that when one was done, the other one was full, you know, and they could switch them out. The differences between that type of stock
delivery. We went to just-in-time, and then, you know, we went to sequencing, so.
When we were running bulk stock, we would have large storage areas with 3 days to a week supply of baskets in them. When we switched over to the just-in-time stock, the bank balances were basically reduced to 3 days or less. And for some of the stuff, it was even within the day that it would come in. Later on, we refined that system to be down to like hours. But to start with, it wasn't the just-in-time thing was just a few minutes late, generally speaking. We didn't always get the things on time the way we were supposed to. It made a lot of hurry at the last minute, but we eventually got that worked out so that things worked. The storage areas were less. We changed packaging on a lot of stuff to make the containers smaller so that we'd have less in them and be able to have more on a timely base.
You were a group leader in that area out there.
There towards the end, yes. Yeah. I was your team coordinator.
So talk about the group leader and the people that worked for you and how they felt about going from a bulk system to a just-in-time system. Did it make your job easier? Did it make it harder?
On the average, it made the individual's job a little more harder, because you had to monitor your own stock a little more closely. When we were doing the just-in-time, I got to be a tugger upstairs, which delivers all the small parts. At the beginning of each day, I'd have to go through and I'd have a large area and look at each part physically and note if we had enough for the whole day or not. And then I would go to the storage area and I would have to note whether we had enough to finish the day with or at least start the day shift with. And then if we didn't, I'd have to go to the controller and have him order more, because a lot of times our computers didn't jive with what we actually had on the floor. Sometimes there was scrap involved. Sometimes there were other reasons why we didn't have what the computers say we had. So you had to physically check every piece to make sure that you had enough for the whole day. That's pretty much a lot of what this just-in-time was all about, is not getting it here any sooner than it needed to be, not storing bulk stuff on the floor or having the excess in our plant so that we were paying inventory costs and so on and so forth. So when we had bulk stock, you could look at it and say, oh, yeah, we got lots, you know, because you could see that there was a lot in the storage area. when we moved to the just-in-time stuff, there was a lot more individual monitoring on a regular basis of what we had in the plant. As I understand it, our controller jobs came about because the supervision needed someone to monitor and order stock on an hourly basis as opposed to being once a day and stuff like that. So a lot of our, we created a jobs to control the stock and the flow of it for hourly employees by going to this just-in-time stuff.
Cheryl McQuaid.
So when you had to go out and physically look at the parts and make sure you had enough, were you ever wrong and shut the production line down? And if that was to happen, what was something typical that would happen because of that?
There have been times when we didn't have enough stock, but there, so much of our car can be put on later that we don't always shut down because of it. And it depends on how many of that car we're going to miss. Because some parts are only used on one car, and we have more than one car flowing down the line, so they would pull it off and do that later, pull it off in the repair areas. But generally speaking, if you messed up on your count, you would be written up or verbally warned, one of the two. Yes, it was a bad thing to not have enough stock to finish your day and not tell anybody. Your job was to find out if you had enough stock and make sure people knew what you had and to avoid problems later on down the road. So it was the first thing you did when you came in was you went and did your counts.
Doug Rademacher. So I want to know, do you feel that the pressure of getting the stock was passed from the supervisor on to the worker?
Yeah, yes and no. It needed more observation, more time. I mean, somebody had to stay on it all the time. You couldn't just order stock once a day. You know what I'm saying? When you're in the body shop, they order floor pans and hood pieces and roof parts, and they would order them pretty much by what the production schedule said we were going to run for the next week, okay, or next day or whatever like that. When the supervisor could do that at the end of each shift. Well, when we moved to the just-in-time stock and stuff like that, he no longer could wait till the end of the shift to be ordering stock. He didn't need to be ordering stock at the beginning of the shift, or maybe if something came up that we were missing, he could hot stock in stuff in, order it in from a, and they would bring it in vans or airplanes or whatever. But he needed to be on it, so they created a position for the hourly employee to do this constant monitoring of stock. So, yeah, in a way, they moved the responsibility for the daily usage onto the employees as opposed to management.
Mark, many times in the material world, things would happen where it would cause a lot of stress for management and the worker, but there were certain things, special things that had to be done to get parts in. You had talked about a little earlier about having parts flown in. What types of things might happen over a course of a full year that would impact a part? Could you share some stories about that?
Well, the flow of stock into our shop is maintained by the trucks that we have, and trucks break down and have to be replaced, and sometimes the trucks don't get here on time. Sometimes the vendors don't keep up with the stock that they need to be sending to us, and so it gets sent late. There were other times when the weather would be a big factor. Snowstorms in Ohio or something like that would slow or almost stop the flow of stock to us. At these times, like when we had bad weather, if we knew the truck was coming, they would keep a crew after the shift, and we would wait until the truck got there and then unload it before going home or whatever. If we needed the stock really bad, it would be flown into the airports, and sometimes we'd get to go out and help them unload the the airplanes and bring the stock in. If it was really, really, see, you understand though that flying stuff in is expensive. We would much rather use vans or trucks to expedite stock in from other places. However, in a very worst case scenario, say like stock coming from Oklahoma, they would fly it into the airport, and we would go out and unload the airplanes and bring it in on trucks from there.
Was there an incident in Oklahoma that you could say where that there was some impact there?
Well, they had that hurricane or tornado that destroyed one of the GM plants down there not too awful long ago, and that put a damper on quite a bit of the other subsidiary businesses in the area. And we were short on quite a few parts from Oklahoma, and for almost 2 weeks we flew stuff in before we got the flow back from them, the ground flow. So,
okay.
Yeah, there were several occasions where stock was flown in just because it was too late or something had happened and they didn't get the stuff. In the stamping plants, they have a problem with dies. Sometimes when they stamp a piece, the die would break. And sometimes it would take up to 2 or 3 days before they would get that die back together. And we would always expedite stock in whatever they had left on hand and try to make it through until they got their dies back up and running and started sending the stock again. I don't know what to tell you.
I've got one. Tell me, as a dock controller or working around them, can you share when stock was loaded into train cars also rather than just trucks? Do you remember times when they couldn't find the parts on the right train car or anything like that?
The only thing we really had on trains was the air conditioners in the trim area there for a long time, and air conditioner parts. So those were like still stocked days and weeks ahead. Even after we started the just-in-time stock delivery, not all of the vendors became just-in-time stock people, and so some of it was still bulk stored, and the train air conditioners were one of them. However, I had a friend that worked down on track 8, and they would unload, I think it was, they had 8 spots, and they would do 2 sets a day, or a shift. And there were plenty of times when they would send him one train and a train car, and he was expecting something to be on it, but it wasn't there, so we'd have to have a train car pulled out and 2 more put back in, an extra switch, so to speak, to try to find the parts that he needed. But
do you know who they worked with to do the train switches?
No,
I don't know which company that was.
No, just a railroad company. As far as I know, at least the railroad company is federally subsidized, so I only thought we had one. And that's about all I know about that. I'm not even sure where they stored the train cars while they're waiting to come here. So.
All right. Do you remember when you hired in, there was changeovers and layoffs? Can you share what happens at that time?
Well, a changeover was when we switched from one model car to another. Generally, it was a time period for the maintenance department to remachine the body shop and put in the new jigs and stuff like that. Some of them took up to 6 months. The average, though, was about 2 or 3 months long. During that time, the majority of our workforce, me included, was laid off. We would become a product of the city at that time, and have unemployment and subpay to make our way, and we would wait until they called us back. Sometimes we'd have a call in date, you know, to come back and start up. But they would basically retool all the machines, and we'd change from one car model to another. And when we came back, we'd learn our operations all over again and start to building the new car.
Well, you referred to unemployment and subpay. Obviously, the unemployment was paid by the state. What is the subpay you spoke of?
It's a subsidiary pay from General Motors to make up for the wage difference between unemployment and your regular wages.
Do you think they were voluntarily giving that, or how do you think that was?
I don't think anybody voluntarily gives any money for anything.
So who might that possibly have been?
That was a direct contribution of our union.
Okay.
I am sure that General Motors would not have voluntarily paid anything if they didn't have to. However, our union helps back us on our wage concessions, and so this is one of the concessions that we have.
What was the longest time you were ever laid off?
I don't remember exactly, but I think about 6 months one time we got laid off. I remember it was a really long layoff. It was like most of the year. So, don't know why. It was early in my career, but I do remember that there was a long period where I didn't have anything to do and I was worried about how to get my... At that time, we had to go to the unemployment office and register for unemployment, and then we had to go back and to each month for the interview to get our check and stuff like that. So, you know, there wasn't any of this computer stuff or mail it to you, you know, or whatever. You had to go in there with your form, and they'd say, well, where did you go to look for work each week, you know? And you'd have to find, you know, three places and go and ask them, put in applications and everything, you know? So at that time, they were really checking, too. So you actually had to be physically looking for work while you were laid off in order to get the unemployment.
And did you ever go through a strike?
We had one that I was actually involved with. It was only maybe about 4 weeks long. I think that's what it was, maybe 3 weeks. It wasn't real long. I got to walk the picket line on the north parking lot. We would carry a sign for 4 to 6 hours a day, and everybody else would come and go and carry signs with you and stuff, and we'd maintain six or seven people at each station around the plant, you know, and carrying signs and walking around in circles. And yeah,
Mike Fleming.
The 4 weeks you were off on your strike, when you came back to your job on 15 Dock, were you on 15 Dock?
I think so.
What? How did that impact you? What was going on out there? Was it chaos? Was it nothing out there? No stock?
No, it was, you know, it's... When you shut the place down and walk away, when you come back, almost everything's where it was. There wasn't really much change at all. It was, I don't know, the layoff and the strike was a political thing. It had nothing to do with production at all. So it was basically everybody just stopped at one time and we left, and then when we came back, everything was right exactly where we'd left it. So starting back up was just as easy as not. I mean, everything was in place. So there wasn't no big change. Changeovers were worse. During changeovers in the material department, you had to remove all of the old stock or outdated stock and package it back up in boxes to be sent off to the parts division plant so that they could, you know, part it out to dealerships as needed. That was for the old cars. But then we'd have to put back new stuff that was coming in. It had new part numbers and new places to go, and we had to put up new racks in places and take down old racks in other places and relabel everything. So when it came to changeovers, there was generally a couple of weeks that everybody else got that material didn't get, because we had a lot of stock changeover to do. We had to remove all the old stock and put in new stock in its place. So that was quite a bit more than the strikes. When we came back from changeovers, there was always that learning the new part numbers, where they went, where the new storage areas was, who would be doing what operations and so on, because some operations ended at the one model year and we would start another one at another model year and all of that. So it was quite different. There was a lot more to a changeover than there was a strike.
Mark, you said you were on the strike.
Yes.
What was your feeling about a strike and walking out?
It's a political thing. It has nothing to do with the individual on the floor. All those decisions were made by others, and you went on strike and you backed your union because your union backs you. Okay, I didn't like being on strike. We didn't get any money for it. However, sometimes it's necessary to do things without pay to get things done. And I viewed strikes as one of those things that it needed doing, and it was up to me to do, so there it was.
Excellent. Can you tell us about things that take place in the workplace for the new guy? When you came in, were there any initiations or pranks that went along with being the new guy?
Yes, there were several of them.
Can you share some of those?
Well, you know how you get to work and you hang your coat up on the coat rack, and you go to work and you do your job all day, and at the end of the day you grab your lunchbox and put your coat on. It was quite a common thing to fill your lunchbox with bolts or your pockets with screws, so that you would have to either take them out of your, you know, you'd pick up your coat and it'd be like 50 pounds. You know, it's usually a 10-pound coat, 5-pound coat, you know, and so that was one of the normal things that went on. There was a whole bunch of pranks that went on that I would consider horseplay at the time with people. So, yeah, there was some hazing that happened when you first hired in. It wasn't nothing seriously. It was mostly how the guys finding out how you're going to react to stress situations, basically. So they would pick on you to find out if you had a good sense of humor or not.
Mike Fleming.
Can you talk about some of those pranks and initiations that went on when you went into material? What did they do to the new material drivers? Can you remember anything?
Yeah, when I was working out in the body shop, there was this guy named Jerry. And I would be busy loading a rack into a platform. And this guy would sneak up behind you and park half inch behind your truck. And, of course, if you didn't turn around and look, because you're backing out of a rack, you never do. You know, you're watching the rack. You don't want to bump it on your way out. You'd smack this guy, like, I mean, full bore. And he'd just sit there and laugh and laugh. And it was one of his pet peeves to get people to look behind him before they back up. So he would get right in there, and you'd never hear him come, and he'd just be there, and you'd go, pow, that would be it. So that was one of them that happened quite frequently. Another one was that they would tell you were out of stock, so that you would have to go run back in and check to see if your stock was there or not, and you weren't out of stock, and the guys weren't even building. You know what I'm saying? There were other pranks that people did, too, so I can't always remember them all. There was one where they would put this black sealant stuff in the ear of the phone, and then they would call you on your phone, on the phone next to your operation, of course, you know, and so you'd pick it up and go to answer the phone, and you'd get this ear full of sealant. That was one of their pranks.
Linda Johnson.
Lou, I was familiar with out on the dock when a person retired or a person died, they had a special ceremony for that person, just for the material drivers. Did you ever participate in any of those?
No, I have heard of them where they line the trucks up and raise the forks to half mast, and everybody beeps their horn as the person drives by. It's a final salute or goodbye to the person going away. I have heard of it. I've seen it once, but that was mostly just done on day shift, because most of your retirees and people that are of that seniority are on days. And so they did that out there. But on nights, we didn't do that. I don't think we had that many people actually retire from nights. Mm-hmm. So we did have one, though, Al Snyder retired this last year, and he was on nights, and we did all that. We had a cake, and it had the Fisher body and logo on it, and he got the plaque, and we had a big dinner and everything right there on the dock. We closed off part of the dock to do this, and which was really hard to do. and we lined all the trucks up and did the final salute for him and took pictures and things. That was really nice for him. So, but only once have I ever had been involved with that. Anything else?
Mark, sure. I'd like to ask you about hiring in with women and minorities. What was your feeling about working around a diverse workforce? Did it have any impact on you? Did you see any conflict with people?
As far as races and things like that are concerned, I'm sure there were quite a bit of them. However, I don't evaluate people like that. Each person is an individual. They all deserve a chance. Until they prove themselves not worthy of that, you know, your support, or you have to treat each person on an individual base. This leaves no room for prejudices. Okay, I might have a problem with somebody of a different ethnic race or whatever, but it's not the whole race, it's that person. You see what I'm saying? There have been other incidents where people would Well, there was one incident where this small Mexican guy decided he was going to beat up this big black guy, and just because, I don't know, because they didn't like each other for some reason or another, they had a minor altercation in it, and both of them spent the next week in the street, no pay. That was early on. That was my first experience with inner shop violence or anything like that. There was some of it around, but I wasn't involved. I have no qualms working with women. I don't really care about if they're black, white, Mexican, green, purple. We're supposed to evaluate each person as an individual, both their work habits and their personalities, and then you decide whether or not you want to be involved with them.
Excellent. Have the environmental conditions inside the the plant changed over the years?
Yeah. It was great. When we changed over from bulk stock to this just-in-time stuff, we stopped having all the extra cardboard boxes. In the years past, when we used the stuff out of the boxes, you'd throw the box out in the aisle. And the sanitation guy would come along about three times a day, and he'd stand there and he'd bust up boxes and stack them in a gondola. Well, when we went over to the just-in-time stock thing, we stopped having that. We stopped having extra boxes. We stopped throwing them away because a lot of these things became returnable boxes and returnable items, even though they were cardboard. And so the environment improved considerably by not having the garbage and the trash in the aisles with the fork trucks. Originally, when you went to go and deliver stock down an aisle, you'd have to go down there with your fork truck and clean the boxes out of the way first so you didn't crush them all on the way through. Push them back into the line and move everybody's racks and stuff around, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, it improved quite considerably. The fresh paint job they put on 8 years ago wasn't too bad. I liked that. It helped to improve the environment. One of the things they did during changeover was to keep a crew of sanitation for nothing but sweeping and cleaning up places that never get to. So each changeover was their big cleanup. They would move all the benches and sweep out from underneath them and stuff. So, but over the years, I guess the biggest improvement was not throwing the boxes out in the aisle anymore.
Mike Fleming.
Blue, can you talk about where you're on the environment? This is, goes hand in hand. Can you talk about some of the safety that the material driver and classes and the types of things that you have to be aware of? First of all, tell me what you did when you first come into the plant before you could even start your day and go from there as far as safety was concerned in material.
Before I started my day.
When you started your day, was there anything you had to do before you got, when you got on your truck? Is there anything particular?
Well, yes. When you first come into the plant and stuff like that, you put your stuff in your locker and you have to get your safety glasses and gloves and stuff like that and get around there. But then when you went out to do your to do your job, you had to do a safety check on your truck to start with and make sure everything was up to par. And if it wasn't, you'd have to take it down to the garage and have it repaired. And if it didn't take too long, then you could have your truck back. But if it did, you had to get a new truck or a different truck. Have to do a safety check on it too. But yes, making sure the equipment was in good working order and you had enough power in the truck to run it, to change the battery if you needed to, that was all part of your responsibility, as well as the operation of the truck and the safe operation and manner of people around you.
And when you, with the safety check, you had to document it, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
And if it was not documented?
Well, management would have a fit to start with. You learned right away that they were serious about this and that you'd better do it every day. I have heard of other people being verbally warned or taken to the office and talked too severely or whatever about the daily safety checks. But I didn't have a problem with it. I liked the idea.
And so as a driver, as you're driving through the plant, what types of safety precautions did you have to be aware of or did you know about?
Well, in the beginning when I first went on, and like I said, with all the trash in the aisles, you had to make sure, for one, you didn't push those boxes back into the line where the people were at, knock somebody over. So you had to be careful about the trash in the aisle to start with. And when you were moving stock in, you had to make sure you didn't hit the platforms that it was being put on or bump somebody that was trying to run by you at the last minute. When you were transporting stock, you had to watch for people coming out from behind the lines between the stock. We had to watch for people in the storage areas that didn't belong there, because sometimes they would come out to count stock and look at the quality of various pieces and stuff like that. And you never know when you're going to run into somebody in a storage area. You know, so.
Have you ever seen any industrial truck accidents or know of any that have happened when you were working?
Yes, there have been a few. There was a time when one of our drivers was talking to the supervisor, and then he backed up and ran over the supervisor's foot and completely crushed the toes and the arch support and everything else. That supervisor was many months not here, and then he wasn't in all that great shape when he came back. He limped quite a bit. There was a Eugene Bovine, so anyway, he drove into the elevator with a load, and then when he went to back up, he stuck his fingers through the top of the cage and backed up out of the elevator. Well, there's only a quarter of an inch clearance between the top of your cage and the top bar on the elevator opening, and it just about cut his fingers off. So he did that one to himself.
What happened to him about that? Do you have any idea what happened?
He had to go to safety classes, and they restricted his license for a while. And at the time, I was a team leader out there, so I had to restrict his activities as well. So he wasn't allowed to use the elevators for a while. And he had this big bandage on his hand for weeks and weeks and weeks. And so, but he had to go and see a safety film about accidents in the workplace, and he had to go to several classes. He had to have so many hours, I think it was 16 hours of safety training, because he had made a mistake and injured himself.
And one last question, and we'll move on. You work around a lot of docks and a lot of train wells.
Mm-hmm.
Any knowledge of anyone coming off of a dock or into a train well?
What was his name? No, it was Barney. Something. He worked out on Dock 15. He got off his truck and walked away, didn't set the parking brake, and Wes' friend hit his truck, and it rolled off the back of the dock, off the front of the dock, I should say, and landed right on its back with its fork straight up in the air. Just sat there. Didn't fall over nothing. That was pretty funny. But we didn't have all that many accidents on nights, not really. The worst accident I've ever seen is somebody dropped the loading plate into the train well, and that took 20 minutes to get out. So, I mean, other than that, there wasn't really much all that serious accidents. We didn't have anybody packed in boxcars or anything like that. So,
Marilyn Coulter.
Blue, you said that you were a team leader. Can you explain to us what a team leader does and what your function was, please?
A while ago, General Motors decided that it was going to go to the team concept, and that all of the plant was going to have team leaders and team organization before the next contract year. Well, they did pretty good with the rest of the department setting up team groups and team stuffs, and it came down to the last 6 months or so of the contract, and then they tried to apply it to material, and it doesn't apply the same way to material as it does to the line. A lot of the values are different. So, but there for a while, I was honored in being the team coordinator for the material department, trim shop. Marlene Dietrich was the team coordinator for the body shop. We actually only had two, whereas we should have had five or six. But it was a lot of, we would have team meetings every week, and we would gather information about the shop, about special events, and we would make sure that people knew what was going on in their work area. If we had specific safety concerns, we would discuss them in the group at the team meetings. If there was events going on or things coming up that they needed to know about, that was discussed. So in material, it was a lot of communication, making sure that everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing in the team coordinator. In the team coordinator, you also had to know what everybody's job was, make sure that they were doing it, find replacements if they were going to be gone, or help supervision find replacements, and make sure the replacements knew how to do the job, and if somebody couldn't keep up, you had to pitch in and help and get them caught back up or do the little extra, whatever it needed to make the things flow better. At the time, we had a lot of AGVs. Those are automatic ground vehicles that would transport stock from Dock 15 to 3X, and they did not run all that well. There was a lot of human intervention to help them get where they were going. So that was a lot of my job, was working with the elevators and keep them running, and working with the AGVs to keep them running and keep the stock flowing to the places it was supposed to be there before it needed to be there. Anything else?
Through your team leadership and things like that, and were there any types of other employee involvement programs that helped you make the material world better for the drivers?
I'm not understanding the question.
Well, when there were certain decisions to be made on things that were being made in changes that were made in material, were the drivers allowed to have any kind of impact on those changes that were made in the material world?
Yeah, the driver is always the one that helps. I mean, management comes up with an idea, but it's the guy on the floor who has to implement it. So a lot of times, you know, we would say, okay, we want you guys to do this, but we're not really sure how we want you to do it. So we would just leave it to the drivers to figure it out, and we would talk to each of the chefs, you know, and see how they were doing it. And within a couple of weeks, we'd come up with a consensus of how it should be done. So, but a lot of the times, it was the guy on the floor that figured out the best way to do it, not management. So, I mean, they don't always know everything.
Now, one last question in terms of trucker safety. I know towards the end, the plant had a safety program where the hourly personnel got to get involved with the truckers. Did you find that those programs helped the safety with pedestrians along with trucks?
I must have missed that one.
The ones where the people were getting on the truck so they could see where the blind spots were on the truck?
Oh, yeah. That was Joe Jadway's baby. He was our safety coordinator, or safety leader, and he set up several places in the shop where there are blind corners and baskets so that people could, and there was one with a fork truck and some baskets to show so people could get on and look and see that we couldn't see all the things every time, you know. I mean, the post on your cage would block your vision in certain places. Your load would block your vision in certain places. As a material person, I don't really notice all that stuff as much as, I mean, I take it for granted that everybody knows this, and because I've been on material, because I take it for granted. But there's a lot of things like being more than 2 feet away from the truck so that you don't get your toes run over. I don't even think about it, and I do that. So, but other people don't realize that there are dangers that they could be in, and so there was some display set up to help them, the average individual, understand what the truck driver was dealing with on a daily basis. But being a truck driver is no different than any other job. It has its hazards. You learn what they are, and you work with them. Okay? I go to work every day knowing that I have the potential to hurt or actually kill somebody with this machine. And the worst part about it isn't that knowing that you could actually do it. It's knowing that it's going to be one of your friends. There's no way around it. It's going to be one of your friends that you hurt. So that's the worst part. You try really hard not to. But things happen from time to time to some people, and people do get hurt.
Mark, this is Doug Rademacher. Mark, the workplace here in Lansing has been called the capital of quality. Is there something that you would attribute the quality and the productivity of this plant?
Well, I haven't been to a lot of other plants, but General Motors in Lansing has done a really good job building cars because we want to build cars. This is what we do. This is what our grandparents did, what our fathers did. Our kids grow up in an industrial area, learning industrial things and looking forward to working in automated shops and places like that. So we have a lot of experience with industrial plants and how to do this and stuff like that. The biggest thing about Lansing General Motors is the people work together really good. They don't have a lot of the prejudices that you find, a lot of the racial disputes that you might run into in other cities. The people in Lansing all want to build cars. That's what we do. That's what we want to do. So I think that attributes quite a bit to the success of the quality of our plants because of the overall determination and the historical education that we have with building automobiles. So, does that fit your bill?
Yeah, so they call your coworkers your family. Do you consider your coworkers your brothers and sisters?
Friends. Not brothers and sisters, because I never liked my brothers and sisters.
That would be a good reason.
Well, I think you'll find this true in most families. You grow up with them, and then you can't wait to get away from them. Okay? When you get together for your family holidays, there's always someone looking to pick an argument. You know what I'm saying? I don't get that with my friends and coworkers, okay? They're always, they smile, shake your hand, pat you on the back, tell you have a nice day, okay? I much prefer this to the punch in the arm and the bickering that goes on at the family reunions.
Okay. And you have lots of memories about Fisher Body. Could you share your best memory of the Fisher Body plant? Something that you remember that was, whether it was moving or it was a warm moment as a friend did something for you?
No, I like the fun things. I worked in a large area, it's building 15, and there was hundreds of employees here. But after a while of working there, we all have hobbies, and I like fishing myself, and there was probably about 7 or 8 of us guys that like fishing. I mean, really like fishing. So one year, we were all just kind of competing with each other on who could catch the most fish and things like that, and we all decided we'd get together one day after work and go fishing. And there was several times after that we did that. But we all got together. We stayed up all night and went out and was out there bright and early in the morning. And everybody caught fish. It was really a good day. So, but that was one of my brightest memories, was getting together with the guys after work and just taking off right from here and going to the fishing hole and fishing all morning until about noon or so. So it was a good day.
Do you have a particular worst day that ever happened at Fisher Body?
That's a hard one. No, not really. Some of them were bad, like the days that we got laid off and we knew we weren't going to be around for a while. That's one of the nice things about Fisher Body and working for General Motors is you know you'll always be back. Sometime or other, we're going to come back and do this again with the same people, same place. You know what I'm saying? So,
okay, Michael Fleming.
Can you talk about? I know you had some pretty good relationships with some of the management people. Can you talk about one of the best management individuals you had to work with as a supervisor, and maybe one of the worst that you can think of, when you were in material?
Well, the best one was I forgot his name. Used to be the MC for the trim. No, the other one.
Rick?
Got hit by the car in that big car.
Tim?
Tim Wampler. He was the best employee. However, Randy Gindrich was very good. I liked Randy Gindrich, only he's not a people person. Whereas, I forgot his name again. Tim Wampler was more of a people person. Randy was really good with making decisions and for working out job, how the job should be put together and what should go with what and who should do what and all that. He was really good with all that, but Tim was just more sociable, and you could sit and talk to him for longer periods of time, and so I got along with him a little bit better. As far as management goes, they were all nice people or good people to work with. Some of them are more people than others, and that makes a difference. But that's about it. They're all there for the end goal, the product, and so they were all easy to work with as far as that goes. You stick to business, you don't have a lot of the social problems.
Well, you also said you one of your hobbies was fishing, but yep. You also did something for coworkers
There was a...
Something that you did on the side. You actually did one for me. This is Doug Rademacher.
There was a time when I was trying... after I had stopped drinking and become more of an adult, that I needed a hobby. And so I took up woodcrafting as a hobby and made knick-knack shelves in the shapes of hearts and things like that and various knick-knacks and bookcases and curio cabinets and desks and just little things like that that I would bring into the shop and I would sell to individuals. I was driving around on this little flatbed anyway, so I just set my stuff up on the back of my flatbed and drove around. If somebody wanted to take a look, better look at my stuff, they'd flag me down. I'd go over and let them buy it or whatever. I can't say that I really made much money on it, but it was good to keep my hands entertained, and it was something that people appreciated. And so woodcrafting became a big part of what I did in there as well. And yes, I made one with a union logo for you. And there was Jeff. He was going to retire, and management told us they couldn't find one of the plaques because you're supposed to have this plaque when you go away. You know, it's got the Goldfisher body on it. And they said he wasn't going to have one. So I made him the colorful one out of wood and carved it all up. And it had his name and his date of hiring and his date of retirement on there. And we presented that to him at his going away party. And he loved it. So there was several things I've done in woodcrafting. But that goes right along with being able to make things. I mean, we make cars. So why not be able to make other things too?
So. You touched on growing up and quitting drinking. Were there any programs that were available to you to help you? Can you share about that?
Well, there for a while, I did get kind of carried away with the alcohol abuse. And one day, one of my supervisors came to me and he says, "You've got a problem." And he handed me this card with Dr. Logan Psychological Evaluation Program that they had for General Motors, and I was able to go to that. And after I got done with him, there was the greenhouse over here. It was supported by the General Motors in the union to help rehabilitating alcoholics. And it was quite useful. I made big use of these programs to help me quit and stay quit. And so...
did that program help a number of people? Can you?
Oh yeah, there was all kinds of us in there. There for a while, a lot of the workforce was young in this plant, and a lot of us drank and partied way too much. And so, as it became more of a controlling factor in people's lives, you would find them in there. I would say at least about a third of the population has been to your AA meetings at the greenhouse. It's been quite useful for supporting people. Maybe not the jobs, but the people anyway.
So that was a joint program where
I think it was
discharging an employee, there was something set up to help them?
General Motors viewed alcoholism as an illness. And so it was something that they would provide you help for and not not fire you for. They would insist on it. If you didn't take the help and use it, you could be fired. But as a general rule, they viewed it as an illness, not as a social disease or whatever, and something that they could treat. You know what I'm saying? And so it was a mental health thing for them.
Well, the union has bargained benefits with the corporation. What was your most appreciated bargain benefit that you have today?
Bargained in my lifetime?
Either that or what are you...
healthcare. The healthcare package that we presently have is a godsend for most people, especially our retirees and things like that. And it's one of those things that you know, if we didn't have it provided, most people wouldn't have it. Healthcare today costs too much for an individual to actually buy and pay for on a regular base. So it's really nice that the healthcare was provided. I guess that's the biggest benefit over the time that I can think of. Wages have been excellent right along too, and I know that's a direct product of the union involvement. there's a lot of things that union and management together have done. Improving work conditions over the years, safety equipment being provided, the various types of safety equipment that they do provide. There's a lot of things that have been negotiated out, but definitely.
As far as union, did you attend your union meetings?
Several of them. When important issues were involved, I came to the meetings.
Did you participate in any of the union activities, the trips that they go on, games, color tours, anything like that?
Not a lot of them, no. Okay. If I'd have had family, I probably would have went to more of them because those are a lot mostly family functions. But being a single male and always being single doesn't lead to that very well.
Do you vote in union in political elections?
Yes. Yes, definitely.
What do you think about that? Is it?
It's the only way I get a say. It's the only way I get a say.
In your community, have you participated in any activities outside of the plant? Or are any of them directly connected from the jobs that you've learned in the plant that you share with the community?
No, I can't say as I have. I don't belong to any other organizations other than the church, and we do plays for the kids, Christmas, Thanksgiving, Easter, things like that. We do various plays occasionally, and I'll be active in that. But as far as community services and things like that, I haven't really been involved in them now.
I want to go quickly back. How long did your father work here, and is he retired?
Oh, yes, my dad has worked here. Well, he hired in when he was 18, but they were going through a hard period where a lot of people were going to be laid off, so he got hired into the Air Force, in the military. I wasn't born until he had been in the military for 3 or 4 years. He worked in the military for 20 years. So when he got out of the military, I was 16, and that was when I went to high school. But he went right back to work here at General Motors after he got out of the military and had been working here for 6 or 7 years before I hired in. And he completed his time and retired, you know, and everything. He worked industrial truck repair. I don't know, he retired several years ago. Lived for 10 years afterwards and died of lung problems, internal fibrosis or something like that.
Well, is there any question I haven't asked you that you would have liked to talk about?
No, not really. Okay. I've enjoyed my time at Fisher Body. I've been there 29 years. I would suggest it for anybody if they had it to do. I'm sure our new plant will be just as much fun as the old one was. It'll just take some getting used to. That's about it.
Well, excellent. It's been a pleasure interviewing you today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill.